Bet the board.
What do you mean you don't bet?
I mean, I don't bet. You know, I don't care. I don't. I never have, and I never will.
Yeah, right.
I'll bet you $20 I can get you gambling before the end of the day.
You owe me $15,000, pal.
Pay him. Pay that man his money.
It's the Bet the Board podcast.
God likes me. He really, really likes me.
In the end, I wound up right back where I started. I could still pick winners, and I could still make money for all kinds of people back home. And why mess up a good thing?
Here's Payne Insider and Todd Furman.
Welcome into the Bet the Board podcast, NFL Week 15, Monday Night Football edition, and talk about some wild, unusual, and historic comebacks that dotted the slate so far this weekend. I'm your host, Todd Furman, joined, as always, by my esteemed colleague and co-host, the one, the only Payne Insider. And Payne, apparently the NFL is quickly adopting the mantra that was privy to the CFL for many years. No lead is safe, and we saw that on full display all weekend long.
It's been going on all season with some of the late game variants. It's what's made the NFL quite wonky this year, in addition to a couple other things. But boy, we had the cherry on the cake this week. I mean, that was not quite sure what we watched unfold in some of those late games. And it started even last week, right, with the heroic comeback from Baker Mayfield, a game and player we'll talk about a little bit later in the show.
Yeah, I mean, 33-point comeback for the Minnesota Vikings to secure victory atop the NFC North. You saw the Tampa Bay Buccaneers blow a 17-point lead. The Dallas Cowboys right there with them, much to the enjoyment of all our loyal listeners, us getting the Jaguars home as the best bet, +4, +4.5, and a variety of other things. But we may as well start with the game that we saw last, and that, of course, was the showdown in the NFC East between the Giants and Commanders. A game in the final sequence marred by what I think can be best defined as some questionable calls from officials in terms of the Terry McLaurin situation, which was a little bit odd, and then what looked like a glorified New York City Manhattan mugging on Curtis Samuel on the fourth down play from Taylor Heinicke.
Listen, I think what we saw unfold there was Brian Daboll and Mike Kafka are just better coaches. And we talked about it a little bit because certainly it was relevant late in the season with Washington having a unique advantage of not just rest time, but being able to prepare for one team for 3 weeks while the Giants had to go through a little bit of a war last week against Philadelphia. And so I thought the game plan was awesome from them offensively. Certainly some tweaks they could have made, but Saquon looked healthy, got him the ball out of the backfield. His game started to enhance a little bit late there as he wore down on Washington's defense. I don't know what to make of it because Washington was able to move the ball. Taylor Heinicke had a couple clutch throws, and he certainly wasn't at fault, but you just start to wonder what Washington is. The win streak's been fantastic, but you look at a lot of these metrics, and like Taylor Heinicke just isn't that dude. And it's a great story, and it's the underdog story that everybody loves. And certainly he gets the guys in that locker room to rally behind him, and he keeps stacking wins, but he's a bad quarterback. And you can just see it in virtually every metric. Again, didn't play horrifically last night, but there were some things he missed. Got very fortunate, threw a pick in the end zone that was dropped late and would have negated some of the shenanigans that unfolded that has casual fans up in arms yelling, fix, fix, fix. Which that would have been the greatest part about that interception is not to deal with that stupidity this morning.
It's honestly amazing. And not to go on a rant and tirade, we obviously talked a little bit about it off air before we kick things off here. The amount of people that think it's all nefarious, and it drives me nuts because we've seen it all the time in officiating. It's not anything nefarious. It's flat out ineptitude. With blown calls and everything else. And the fact that you have people closely tied to prominent positions with major networks suggesting that there is a level of impropriety without investigation, without a variety of different things going on, it drives me absolutely bonkers that you want to call in to question the integrity of the league from start to finish.
Yeah, we're fixing the biggest games in front of a national audience for everyone to rant and rave about them. You know, just it makes no sense. At the end of the day, right, you look at some of these guys and we don't age discriminate because we're all going to be old at some point, but you look at the caliber of athlete. They're bigger, they're stronger, they're faster. And you look at the guys officiating these games and you just wonder how they're able to keep up. Now, certainly the Terry McLaurin situation is a little bit different. But at the end of the day, we all have our bad days, right? And we all miss a 2-foot putt from time to time. And so I think Mike Pereira said that yesterday. And you know, whatever we think of Mike Pereira on TV, not coming up with decisive conclusions on what he's actually asked to do. The reality is he made this analogy yesterday and it kind of shut everybody up. It's like, you know, have you ever missed a 2-foot putt before? And so it happens. These guys are human. The interesting part of the pass interference, no pass interference call, it's like you kind of want to let these guys play and you don't want to decide the game. Was there some physical contact there? Yes, but it's a division game. It's a division rivalry. It's fourth down. It's like you really have to mug somebody to see a flag there. And we all want the games decided on the field. But the moment it's not, right, then we're up in arms about it.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, I don't even know what's going on sometimes at various points. But either way, big win for the New York Giants. They put themselves in firm control of one of the wild card spots in the NFC, and we move forward with things. On Monday mornings, as we always do, it's about the good, the bad, and the ugly. Some look-ahead lines later on. A good Doc Deepak stops by to fill us in on injury updates, one season ending for those folks that may have had fantasy glory in mind. They're dealt an unfortunate blow, and of course, a preview of the Green Bay Packers playing host to the Los Angeles Rams. So I'll let you kick off the good, the bad, and the ugly this morning. What stood out to you in a positive manner?
I think just where we ended last podcast, we should probably pick up. And I know there were some question marks about what we gave out, but it's you can kind of tell the people that listen to every show. And this is the third time that Trevor Lawrence has found his way onto the good list since we said he needed to grow up and mature and become a leader that other men wanted to follow. And I thought Trevor Lawrence was fantastic yesterday, not just in the production, right? I mean, he did finish quarterback 7 in EPA plus completion percentage over expectation. He brought Jacksonville back from a 17-point third quarter deficit, made some ridiculous throws, right? Navigated the pocket extremely well. And at one point, he was playing without both starting tackles. But for me, what I watched was him, right? There was a situation where he missed a huge explosive pass where he reads the Cowboys defense wrong and ends up throwing a pick. But after that, Lawrence keeps his head up, clapped his hands, jogged off to the sideline pretty briskly, right? There wasn't this head drop. He wasn't pouting. He wasn't throwing a temper tantrum. The body language didn't depict to the rest of the team that the game was over. It was just a completely different vibe. And, you know, part of the handicap last week was Trevor Lawrence and the way he was playing and attacking what we thought was a shorthanded Cowboys secondary that was down a couple key cogs. And coming into last week, we had, I think, talked about the way he was protecting the football and dug up this stat. But Trevor Lawrence, coming into this pass game against Dallas, had 30 or more passing attempts in 5 straight games without an interception. That was making Lawrence the youngest player in the NFL since 1950 to do that. So he cleaned up the game a little bit, was on a nice little run with 11 touchdowns, 0 interceptions, but kind of just willed his team to that win, turned it over on the fumble as well, but just, again, kept his head up. Everyone kept believing. And so we'll see what it looks like with more pressure Thursday night now that Jacksonville is truly in the playoff race.
Yeah, Tennessee's struggles right now have opened the door for the Jacksonville Jaguars to see a clearly defined path when you look at their finishing kick on the road at the Jets. They'll play the Houston Texans in a game that could decide AFC South supremacy week 18, where they'll play host to the Tennessee Titans, who are currently reeling. I want to go to your backyard and give credit to the Miami Dolphins, Payne, albeit in a losing effort. And we know there are no hollow platitudes, there are no moral victories, there are no participation trophies at this level. But I thought the Dolphins, in the face of adversity, rose up to the challenge, coming up just short. Raheem Mostert, 17 carries, 136 yards, allowed the Dolphins to be formidable running the football against the Bills. Some of that tackling that we know has plagued them all year was on full display that you've highlighted on multiple accounts. Jalen Waddle gets back involved, capitalizing on a big play or two to take some of the pressure off Tyreek Hill. They dealt with the weather, the Bills' defense. They averaged over 7 yards per play, but the Achilles heel, as it's been all season long, continues to be that secondary. They just couldn't get a key stop to get what would have been a massive road victory for them in their eye to get to the postseason.
Yeah, I think if you're gauging this game from an unbiased perspective, the Dolphins outplayed the Bills in virtually every phase. They were more physical up front on both sides, whether it was that ground game you referenced there, whether, you know, Mostert and Ahmed went for nearly 8 yards a carry. On the other side, Josh Allen was pressured on 37% of his dropbacks, and I know he was down his center and his guard, and you know, there's a couple guys along that offensive line with Brown and Saffold that just can't pass protect, so some pressure was coming in there. But you also had Waddle and Tyreek both scoring. The cold water, you know, weather didn't really seem to impact things. In fact, Miami kind of embraced it all week. Tua, I thought, played his best game in Buffalo to date. And unfortunately, the largest mismatch became too much to overcome. And, you know, we saw the Dolphins, talked about it multiple times. Anytime we break down a Dolphins game, three starters out in the secondary just could not compete with Josh Allen. And the Achilles heel for the last decade, anytime we again break down these Dolphins games, it was out in full force and the world could see it. Miami just cannot cover tight ends or running backs. And so if you look, 13 of Josh Allen's 25 completions went to tight ends and running backs. All four of Josh Allen's passing touchdowns to a tight end or running back. 13 catches for 155 yards and four touchdowns from those two positions. That's something we highlighted Thursday, saying, sure, like, Diggs is going to be important here, but this is very much a Knox, Singletary, Cook, and Hines game, and that's how it unfolded, and now you have a massive Christmas Day game for Miami. The positive, though, even with the loss, Dolphins playoff odds increased this week. Huh?
Yeah, when the other dominoes around you fall the right way, sometimes you don't have to go out there and win games that you're participating in. You can get help everywhere else throughout the league. I do want to ask you a quick follow-up, and you've highlighted the Dolphins' ineptitude in that particular arena. Is it more scheme-driven? Is it personnel? Is it a combination of factors that have made athletic tight ends that are viable pass-catching options along with running backs their Achilles heel over all these years?
Yeah, it's a little bit of scheme. It's mostly not having great coverage linebackers. I think they're relying on Baker just to be that guy, and he hasn't been yet at this point. It'll be interesting to see if Mike McDaniel makes a change at defensive coordinator. Obviously, liked what he saw on film, and he decided and elected to keep their current defensive coordinator, but I'm not quite sure he'll go that route. Now, in the Dolphins' defense, the secondary is in shambles, and this is a passing league, and Buffalo is very much a passing offense, and it's very difficult when the guy you're paying a gazillion dollars and Xavien Howard is playing well below expectation. You're down a starting safety, you're down your number two corner, who you're paying also a gazillion dollars, and you're down your slot corner. And it just makes it difficult, and that's why they went out and got Bradley Chubb to bring some pressure to negate that area, and that was their goal, right? Like, we just have to get to the quarterback before the quarterback can actually release it. And coming into this week, since acquiring Bradley Chubb, the Dolphins were fourth in pressure rate over that time frame, so it's helped to an extent, but just Josh Allen was simply too good.
Yeah, I mean, he looks like he's built obviously to play through inclement weather in Buffalo. Answered the bell there. Buffalo escapes with the slimmest of victories by a field goal with that kick as time expired. The Pittsburgh Steelers, Payne, for me, stood out when you look at the way that the market had adjusted to Carolina's win in Seattle. We saw that number jump the fence, got as high as three before there was a little bit of resistance there, but the Steelers were effective running the football, 156 yards and three touchdowns on 45 carries. They held a 13-minute edge in time of possession, converted 12 of 16 third down opportunities, largely because they were in third and manageable. But more importantly, Mitchell Trubisky, who was horrific in terms of his judgment and interceptions he threw in the 16-14 loss against the Ravens, was significantly better. The Steelers buttoned up against the run in what I thought was a hard-fought victory for the Steelers against the Panthers team still playing for their playoff lives.
Yeah, it was box to wire. And specific to Mitchell Trubisky, he's probably not a franchise quarterback, but you do kind of feel bad for him. I mean, he was fib two when he signed with Pittsburgh, and he's playing in a Matt Canada offense, and that's not going to be the best offense because Matt Canada isn't the best offensive mind. And if you listen closely, in passing last week we mentioned, and it's a big if, right? But if you removed the three interceptions against Baltimore, and again, they were bad interceptions, Trubisky was actually number one in EPA plus completion percentage over expectation in week 14. And then Tomlin tried messing with Trubisky again this week, making him share first team reps in practice with Mason Rudolph, who we all know isn't that guy. And remember, like, Trubisky is very much out there playing for his next job. He wants to be aggressive. He wants to show to the world that he can throw the ball. And so, yes, like, the Steelers' ground game was good enough yesterday, despite not being explosive or efficient. defense played better situationally, although Darnold hit some massive chunk throws. But to me, this was about Mitchell Trubisky being wildly efficient again. And you could see it. He was getting the ball out on time. He knew where the ball needed to go. Trubisky kept it out of harm's way. And again, for the second week in a row, Trubisky finished quarterback number one in EPA plus completion percentage over expectation for week 15. And I am seeing a guy that, to me, runs this offense better than any quarterback currently in that room. Now, I'm sure Kenny Pickett will take over the job in what would appear to be a lost season, although they're not mathematically eliminated yet. But we'll see with what they go with Sunday night, or Saturday night, rather, against the Raiders.
The dream lives, Payne. Mike Tomlin never had a losing season. He wins out, can finish 9-8. Would be one of the more improbable results. Obviously, the big question for the Steelers, can they get to 8 wins and exceed odds makers' expectations coming into the year, where their win total sat at 7.5? What else stood out to you in a positive manner?
I think this will probably surprise some people, or they'll just call me an idiot and a homer and all that stuff. But when you think about, you know, a team that dilly-dallied all game, they probably shouldn't make this list because they didn't exceed expectation. They needed overtime to beat an inferior opponent. But, like, what about Patrick Mahomes? It just amazes me that the overarching sentiment is, yeah, this is what it is, right? We just kind of continue sweeping Mahomes' performances under the rug. The bar is just set so damn high, and the baseline for expectation is just through the roof that we just think, oh, yeah, another day at the office. And so it just gets lost in the shuffle what he did yesterday. Like, who cares who you're playing? 36 for 41. Completion percentage nearly 17% over expectation, whether he was targeting Kelce, Juju, or McKinnon. 28 times those three guys were targeted by Mahomes. 28 times Mahomes completed those passes. And so I just think a lot of our listeners, you certainly have heard it from other content creators. Mahomes was dead when Tyreek Hill left. And Tyreek Hill has a chance to set the all-time receiving records in a season. And through 15 weeks, Mahomes is still quarterback number one in EPA plus completion percentage over expectation. And I can tell you with 100% certainty, if Kansas City played with Chad Henne, they'd have far fewer wins than if Gardner Minshew quarterbacked the Eagles. Okay? And so, aside from the numbers, I think that's how we deem most valuable. So it'll be interesting to see if we get the MVP award right this season. My fear is that we probably won't, although if Dallas can somehow beat Philadelphia next Saturday, it might swing things back in Mahomes' favor if he's able to get a win against the Seahawks.
Yeah, I'm not sure it's what you want to hear, but I would be surprised, not because of anything he's done as far as him being Patrick Mahomes winning the MVP, but more along the lines of, to your point, setting the bar so high. And Mahomes isn't competing against the rest of the league. He's competing against himself. I'll be honest, with that Texans-Chiefs game yesterday, I didn't really watch until late in the game. Saw Harrison Butker's miss 50-plus yard field goal at the end of regulation. Figured when I was going to dig into the box score that it'd be relatively even, and was blown away that it was the Chiefs with nearly a 300-yard net advantage offensively. 6.6 yards per play to the lowly 3.8 for the Houston Texans, and yet somehow Houston hangs around, easily covers as a 14-point underdog, but absolutely dominated from start to finish on the stat sheet.
Yeah, there was no doubt about it. They were able to run it. They were able to throw it. Some turnover woes, some variance that went awry. But to your point, I mean, despite those discrepancies of what transpired actually on the field, Texans were never outside the number. And once we got to like 14.5, 15, very sharp group came in on the Texans, and certainly they were quite happy about that despite being dominated in the run of play.
It's a friendly reminder in this business, how many things have to go right. If you're going to lay double digits in the NFL, even with one of the best teams in the league against the worst, you need the perfect sequence of events to comfortably get outside the number. And it's why for all those years when I was behind the counter, I mean, the old school guys would tell me, you have a chance to take double digits, doesn't matter how bad the team is, you're going to want to try and gravitate towards making a case in that particular instance. And the Houston Texans highlighted that reason in full force. Before we go into the bad, I wasn't sure if there was anything else you wanted to include.
No, I think we covered some ground there, unless you have anything else.
Nope, nothing else from my end. I mean, those were some of the overarching storylines that I wanted to make sure we carved out some time for. But from the good to the bad, and I'll take the low-hanging fruit, which, of course, would be the Tampa Bay Buccaneers' effort, not in the first half, where they looked every bit worthy of a NFC playoff dark horse, but the second half, where they completely imploded, allowing 34 unanswered points, including the field goal to close the first half from the Bengals, where they went into a prevent defense that, like a jump shooter, allowed the Bengals to feel confident in things that they hadn't done for the first 29-plus minutes of the half. And then they put together a drive summary against that looked like this. The Bengals, 5 plays, 13 yards, kick a field goal. 7 plays, 31 yards, touchdown. 5 plays, 13 yards, touchdown. 8 plays, 39 yards, touchdown. The Bucs defense, they deserve a game ball because they held strong, albeit wearing down late in that contest. Gave up just 237 yards and 3.8 yards per play. But the Buccaneers offense, highlighted by Tom Brady, was very much in the holiday spirit because they were extremely generous handing the football over to the Bengals on 4 straight drives.
So this was the first time in 90 games that Tom Brady had lost a home game with a lead of 17 or more. And I thought, to your point, the Buccaneers' game plan in the first half was more aggressive than what we've seen, and they showed some imagination. You had the fourth down and goal where they decided to go for it rather than kick the field goal, which was a nice change up for a team led by a defensive mind. But when you look, this was an offense that generally was running far too much on early downs. They were using some of the league's lowest rates of both motion and play action, all the things that actually help an offense. But in the first half, I thought the Bucs looked pretty good. Fourth best EPA of week 15. But you mentioned some of that sloppy play. But yes, that was part of it. I think the other thing that we've kind of talked about here and have led this charge, it was Lou Anarumo happening as well. And I think we've lauded him for some of his halftime adjustments, and for about a season plus, whether it's an over or thinking about taking a stance against the Bengals, we're really trying to make a case for the first half and not the full. And again, in the second half, you saw some adjustments from Lou Anarumo, and the Buccaneers were held to a league low negative 0.59 EPA per play in that second half. Even if you remove the turnovers, 25th out of 30 offenses in the second half this week for the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. So it just wasn't the sloppy play. There's a lot of adjustments made from Anarumo, and I think the Bengals defense, if you've read some post-game comments, they weren't happy with what Tom Brady had said earlier the week when he deemed them a fairly tough defense. Apparently that became some bulletin board material for the Bengals this week.
I just would have liked to see the half play out and see the Bengals actually need to drive the field more than anything else. I'm not going to disparage anything that the Bengals accomplished defensively, but to Joe Burrow's credit, even with what looked like an emaciated pinky that was not so pleasant to look at during the course of the telecast, they find a way to win, and the Bengals are the greatest thing in the betting market, as they can attest to, moving their record to 19-3 against the spread over their last 22 games, something that's not supposed to happen with a team that was the runner-up last year for the Lombardi Trophy. As far as other bad, one other thing that stood out to me, and I know everyone, Payne, wants to highlight, oh, Minnesota was tremendous in coming back. You know, they erased a 33-0 deficit, becoming the first team since 1930, or second team, excuse me, to trail by more than 30 points and still win. My biggest question is, if you're a good team, you shouldn't get down 33-0 to a team like the Indianapolis Colts and find yourself in this particular spot. So credit to Kirk Cousins and everybody for dealing with adversity. But at the same time, it's bad when you find yourself in this kind of gargantuan hole and yet again come out flat and fail to exceed odds makers' expectations. So for all those Vikings fans out there that go, oh, the betting market doesn't like us, there's good reason. You continue to put on tape, but you are a very average football team.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I think we know the Vikings aren't an elite team at this point, and Minnesota certainly isn't as good as their record, and I think that's become obvious to even some of the laymen. So they've become the easiest punching bag, and I try to avoid throwing punches when that is kind of the circumstances we're dealing with. But you can roll the tape. I think when we gave out Washington as a best bet back in week 9, one of the talking points was having the 6-1 Vikings that everyone seemed to love power rate as the 14th best team. And we haven't wavered. And so Minnesota for us is still outside the top 10. I actually thought the comeback was impressive. Now, never good getting down 33 to nothing.
For sure.
And if it were a better team than the Colts, it never happens.
Yeah, I mean,
right? But it's like, you know, it's a blocked punt for a TD. It's a pick six. It's a kickoff return to start the game that sets up a short field. I think there's better spots for us to pile onto the Vikings in my mind.
All right, we won't pile on then. We'll pick a spot this week, and if they lose outright to the Giants.
Pile on. Go for it. Finish it. Yeah, I mean, the line certainly says the Giants win again, but that just tells you what the market is.
More of the market than anything else.
Guys.
All right, what else? What else do you want to include in the bad bucket?
I think the one of the worst coaching performances of the entire week came on Saturday. It was Ravens offensive coordinator Greg Roman. I mean, Baltimore fans will get fiery about this because they believe Greg Roman probably should be out of a job already at this point, and he very may well be. But I just didn't understand what he was doing. Even the most casual fan could understand what was going on in that game. I mean, you're playing the Cleveland Browns, who, one, there's some weather in the game. There's some wind. There ended up being some snow flurries. Cleveland's 30th in schedule-adjusted rush defense. One of the best edge setters in Jadeveon Clowney left the game early with an injury. Didn't play in the entire second half. And you have Dobbins and Edwards, who are averaging 9 yards a carry. 62% of runs graded successful on the day. Huntley couldn't hit the broadside of a barn. Right, and somehow J.K. Dobbins had 2 carries from the 9-11 mark of the third quarter until the rest of the game. Right, the last time Baltimore ran the ball was at the 14:54 mark of the fourth quarter. One running back carry the final 3 drives, and this isn't a planet where like Dobbins and Edwards can combine for 20 carries and Huntley throws it 30 times. Greg Roman's pretty lucky that he's finding himself, I think, on the bad list here because that was ugly, and it wouldn't surprise me, and I still think they make the playoffs, obviously. It wouldn't surprise me if there's a change offensively, even in a decent season for Baltimore. I don't know. It would depend on how large the playoff run is, if there is one. But if you get an early exit, or God forbid you somehow miss the playoffs, like Greg Roman's on the firing block.
It sounds ridiculous to say, but the one who's benefiting the most watching the Ravens the last couple weeks is clearly Lamar Jackson. He should just see that cash register going on in his head and the dollar sign starting to accumulate going, this is the offense you guys want to run. This is what happens when I'm shelved. Such an interesting dilemma for where Baltimore will be, not only from the coaching spot, but in terms of what kind of long-term deal, if they do offer one to Lamar, what that looks like and how they continue to build going forward and try and get the elusive playoff wins that you referenced. Anything else?
I think what you're seeing there, though, right, is it's not just what Lamar means to the offense, but it's what the offense is around him. True. We know they haven't allocated a ton of money. And so when he's not operating that offense, suddenly you're seeing, oh, my God, our wide receivers are like a 48-year-old from California that somehow still has speed. And DeMarcus Robinson, who the Chiefs kind of just let walk away. And there's just not much else there. I mean, even in that game where it's like, yes, run the ball. And Dobbins, I think, what, 125 rushing yards. The guy's out there on one leg doing it. So there's just not a ton around Lamar Jackson. And so when he's out, the drop off is even a little bit larger because you don't have a guy making up for a lack of weapons around him.
Yeah, pretty wild. I mean, we knew Rashad Bateman added some value there, but this is it's a tough watch when you look at the vertical passing game and try and figure out where the Ravens need to go when they're hunting big plays. Mark Andrews also looking like a shell of himself. I know he hasn't shown up on the injury report, but clearly not 100%, and you wonder how big an impact that's having on everything Baltimore wants to do trying to move the football downfield. Last but not least, we always have the ugly classification. I want to give you honors here. I had 2 things that stood out to me. One for a specific play that ended up breaking their backs, and one, of course, for what we saw unfold in the desert that I haven't been able to wrap my head around just yet.
I'll let you start with that because that was the first one I had on my list. It's obviously low-hanging fruit, but what a wild ending with Jacoby Myers. I don't understand the thought process.
Yeah,
though.
I don't either. And to Jacoby Myers' credit, he owned it. So I give a player credit for that in a very difficult spot. Didn't get defensive, said this is on me. I tried to go out there and make a play, But good Lord, Payne, I watched that. I had to rewatch it multiple times because I wasn't sure what the hell was going on. And it even had me second guessing the score, that it was somehow that the Raiders had a 1-point lead and the Patriots needed to make things happen. When you run the draw play to Ramondre Stevenson, he laterals, which is probably not the best in the grand scheme of things. Relatively low risk, though, in that particular situation. Then you turn and see Jacoby Myers look to chuck it back across the middle of the field into the waiting arms of Chandler Jones, who stiff arms Mac Jones, much like you'll see aunts and uncles in a family turkey bowl against the three-year-old nephew en route to going to the end zone. And just the look on Bill Belichick's face when the camera pans there, I've never seen anything like it. And for a team who needed that game to get into the playoffs, who had erased a 17-3 deficit against a Raiders side known for blowing big leads this season, one of the more incredible moments of the entire season this year, and maybe over the last 10 to 15 years, given what it meant.
Just wild. And I know a lot of people were bagging on Bill Belichick for attempting to score points there late, right? And it was like, you don't have an elite quarterback. What are you doing trying to push the ball down the field with Mac Jones at the start of that possession, rather, right? It's like, just take knees and go to overtime. It's just, you're thinking, like, what are we talking about here? Like, the Raiders have one of the worst pass defenses in the league. But even late, you see the handoff to Ramondre Stevenson. That is not on Bill Belichick. That is effectively Bill Belichick saying, hey, we're ending this game. We're just going to run a draw here and play out the clock, and we'll take it to overtime. It's not until Ramondre Stevenson kind of sees some daylight there and is like, ooh. And the instinct was to pitch it back. And to your point, Jacoby Myers said the right things, and it's clearly on him. You just don't know the thought process there, because even if Mac Jones does catch it, he can't throw it forward again. And Mac Jones, 60 yards away from the field, wearing his knee brace, probably isn't scootering to the end zone. So you're just not quite sure what the thought process was. He lost his mind in the moment, and probably the wildest ending that I've ever seen.
Yeah, I mean, we can add to Mac Jones' otherwise unimpressive stat line, 13 for 31 throwing the football, one missed tackle that put on top of all of that. And here the Raiders are.
He was more like a speed bump there in his defense.
That was pretty funny to watch. And honestly, social media rarely lets me down in that regard, but I was stunned that there weren't any slow motion memes of Chandler Jones just basically running directly over him. I will give Josh McDaniels credit. He said the only thing he was thinking at that point in the game was, please don't let the quarterback tackle you in the open field. Pretty sure McDaniels knew if that game went to overtime, the Raiders' odds of winning that were probably about 12%. But then again, I would have given him a 5% chance to even force overtime, given what we'd seen the entire second half before they had that game-tying drive to get that thing to 24 apiece. So, ridiculous finish.
I think that's the biggest issue with the Patriots. Like, how many weeks in a row can you watch them come out with horrific game plans and start slow and be uber conservative? It's every single week. And so, all of a sudden, you make some halftime adjustments, you're forced to be a little bit more aggressive, and what do you know? You can score some points. And this is what we're continuing to watch. If the New England Patriots want to make the playoffs, they need to come out with better game plans. They need to come out being a little bit more aggressive. And I know a lot of people right now are down on Mac Jones. But the reality is, it's these game plans. It's these scripts. They've been horrific. And anytime Mac Jones in the last couple weeks is actually forced to play catch up, that's when they seem to move the ball. And so this isn't just a Jacoby Myers thing. In the moment, it's the biggest thing. He was the problem. It caused the loss. But the reality is, how about you come out with a better game plan or script?
Oh, it's...
How about you not virtually get shut out in the first half to one of the league's worst defenses?
Yep, there is no doubt it's something bigger. And an underlying concern there, not only from a conservative game plan execution, this sequence down around the goal line where the Patriots were forced to settle for a field goal was a legitimate travesty to try and watch. The blocked punt going into the half that gave the Raiders an opportunity to extend a 10-3 lead, make it 17-3, just a comedy of errors and the things that we haven't grown accustomed to from New England, who is typically the model of being buttoned up, doing the little things it takes to win games, where it's two or three plays every single Sunday that can swing the balance, not obviously just in covers, but in terms of straight up wins and losses. I want to stick in the division and be critical, not of their full body of work, because I think the Jets defense was outstanding given how erratic Zach Wilson was. I wasn't fooled by his 300 plus yards passing. There were a couple of broken plays. He made big plays, I guess, when they were needed. Had a gross interception, some other throws he's got to make, but fourth and inches from midfield, you know the Lions need a touchdown. You give up a 50-yard touchdown pass, and the reality of it is that may be the play pain that keeps them out of the playoffs, and that long-standing postseason drought at MetLife Stadium may continue for Gangrene.
So, you know, in totality, to your point, the Jets' defense was pretty damn good, and they actually made some wild adjustments. They were getting beat up a touch in man coverage early, and for four straight drives, they flipped to zone and regained some of their footing, and it was a smart move from Salah, and nobody actually saw it coming because we know how much better that Lions offense is when they're faced playing a zone defense. So, It's tough for me to kind of bag on the Jets, and I was a little surprised to see it made the ugly list. And, you know, when you look at their season-long splits without Quinn and Williams on the field, it's a completely different defense. Yep, I mean, in sure. some settings, without Quinn and Williams on the field, like they're like 30th in some metrics. And so to hold the Lions to six offensive points the first 57 minutes is actually pretty impressive to me. Now, yes, you got out-schemed on fourth and one, and then you had the special teams blunder to start the game. But to your point, like, don't be confused by Zach Wilson's passing yards here. If you give up as a defense 6 points the first 57 minutes of a game, you're going to win a ton of those. And unfortunately, you know, Zach Wilson was a little bit of a problem again here.
Yeah, and we'll see exactly what happens on Thursday night if Wilson is the man under center against the Jacksonville Jaguars. All right, your chance for the ugly, and then we can head off into look-ahead lines land.
No, I think we just head to look-ahead lines. To your point, though, about the Thursday night situation, the rumor is that it's not going to be Mike White again. We'll see. I know Florio had the report leading up to Sunday Night Football that they didn't believe, at least the information he was receiving, that they would clear Mike White to play, that he's got a couple broken ribs and another hit could force a puncture, and that the rib hasn't had a chance to calcify yet. And so they believe it will be someone other than Mike White under center on Thursday night. We'll see if that ultimately unfolds. A lot of time from now until Thursday, but that was the initial viewpoint from at least the information Mike Florio was getting that he delivered ahead of Sunday Night
Those
Football.
Poor Jets fans. So close, yet oh, so far away with three games to play in the regular season. You can follow Payne on Twitter, at Payne Insider. I'm Todd Furman. You can follow me there. Most importantly, follow the podcast, at Bet the Board Pod. Look ahead lines, Payne Lions. 2.5-point road favorites early last week. We've seen that number tick up to the key number of 3 for their trip to Charlotte to take on the Carolina Panthers.
Yeah, so the Lions continue to win. Carolina loses a big game at home, and now it looks like, you know, somehow you're still mathematically involved here. But ultimately, that's the cause for this line movement, is Detroit wins again. Carolina falls on its face. It'll be interesting to see where this goes from here, though. I wonder if that number is enough to get some people involved at that key.
Cincinnati, 3-point road favorites for their trip to Foxborough, second straight week. They'll be on the road against the New England Patriots. That number now out to 3.5 most books, and even a rogue 4 out there now for this matchup.
Yeah, you know, I'm interested to see where this ultimately goes. It feels like a game where obviously the Bengals have a lot to play for, but it does have that element of the Patriots season being on the line here. The question becomes something we just stated a couple minutes ago for both of these teams. If the Patriots come out with the horrific game plan again, and you have a great defensive mind in Lou Anarumo who makes halftime adjustments, and that's typically where the Patriots are scoring their points in comeback mode, what's the path? But I do think we get to a point again where, you know, if you get to 4 and it's the Patriots season and you have a defensive mind like Bill Belichick, does he come up with something here to give Joe Burrow a little bit of trouble? And to your point in the recap of Bengals Bucks, even though they scored 34 and answered, it wasn't like the Bengals offense was just humming, right? I mean, about 4 yards per play during that onslaught of points. So this is one that's interesting, going to need a little bit more time with it, but ultimately that is why we're seeing this tick up. It's the Bengals winning and covering again, and the Patriots coming out with another slow start and falling flat late.
Tennessee Titans, 8.5-point favorites, playing host to a divisional foe in the Houston Texans. On the look ahead number, that number ticked down to a key number of 7 amid Houston's back-to-back strong performances, at least on the scoreboard, against the Dallas Cowboys and the Kansas City Chiefs.
You hit it perfectly, right? Back-to-back weeks covering the number, strong performance against Dallas. You have your starting quarterback who should be the one playing. It's a divisional game. It's, you know, a familiar environment. You're typically, when you're playing Tennessee, you're not wanting to lay points with them. But the other thing here is, let's see the status of Ryan Tannehill, right? Obviously left the game on a cart, got shot up, got taped up, returned to the game. That's fine in the moment when the adrenaline's going, but how healthy is he going to be this week? So that's part of this move.
And I also know you're excited, like the rest of the NFL world, to spend your Sunday eating Christmas dinner, watching the Tampa Bay Bucs on the road against the Arizona Cardinals, a game that had been Tampa -3, that number out in that 4.5-5 range. Let me tell you one thing about this game, Payne. Penn State fans love them some Trace McSorley. I took a shot at what he did in college for declining stat lines over his 3 years there. Apparently, Penn State fans didn't want to acknowledge that Saquon Barkley and Mike Gesicki had an awful lot to do with McSorley being a world beater his sophomore year and regressing to a slightly above average quarterback by the time he left Happy Valley.
That's ultimately the first move here, is the thought process with the Bucs still in control of their own destiny. And getting out, laying that 3, which is a massive key number. And if it's Trace McSorley, they think they have a great bet. If somehow Colt McCoy gets upgraded off the concussion, then suddenly we have the ability to, if we want, play the middle game around the 3 and the 4. And so that's what we've seen here with the Buccaneers. If it's Trace McSorley, and that's kind of been the coin flip proposition, right? These concussions are typically taking 1.5 weeks. So we'll have to keep our eyes peeled on the status of Colt McCoy. But you're looking at Trace McSorley, who was the worst quarterback yesterday in virtually every single metric. I mean, completion percentage, almost 25% below expectation.
It was ugly. Let me tell you, I watched that third and fourth quarter for whatever reason, because I'm a glutton for punishment. I'm not sure what that was when he dropped back in the pocket, looked to try and throw.
Well, I could tell you the reason, I'm not going to divulge that to the listeners.
My reading comprehension is that of a second grader, is the main reason that I was actually watching that game, which is a good story, one that we're not going to tell on this podcast, but I'm glad that you're able to laugh. Thankfully, it all had a happy ending, so we'll leave it at that. You mentioned injuries being a huge part of the game, Colt McCoy and concussion protocol. You and I, we like to think of ourselves as smart guys. We're not nearly as smart as a guest who's been joining us most Mondays throughout the course of the season. You, of course, can follow Deepak Shona on Twitter at SportMDAnalysis as he provides his weekly injury update.
Are you injured or are you hurt?
When injuries occur in the NFL, you need someone to call on.
If you're hurt, you can still play. If you're injured, you can't.
Let's check in with Dr. Deepak Chona. Stanford and Harvard-trained orthopedic sports surgeon and founder of SportsMed Analytics, the industry leader in data-driven injury analysis.
So are you hurt or are you injured?
All right, thanks, guys. Tons to discuss today, so let's dive right in, starting with Justin Fields. Now, the injury video, in combination with the way they were stretching him out and the fact that he returned so rapidly, altogether suggest that Fields was battling some calf cramps. Not expecting any lingering impact here, but we'll be checking for his return to practice this Wednesday to confirm. Now, if the cramps do end up being the confirmed diagnosis, he shouldn't be at any increased risk for performance impact or re-injury in Week 16. And then Ryan Tannehill. Now, the video was pretty convincing for a high ankle sprain. Most of these would cost QBs at least 1 to 2 games, but of course Tannehill was able to stay in. It did look like he was limping at times in the fourth quarter, but with his heavily pocket-based style, he's likely to continue to play without major performance impact. He will, however, have an elevated re-injury risk going forward. And then Jaylen Waddle. Now, most upper extremity issues are not tied to performance hits for wide receivers. Look for Waddle to return to practice early this week and play without much impact on his production. And then Jonathan Taylor. Unfortunately, less optimism here. Reaggravated ankles are prone to further injury, including some that wouldn't just heal on their own. So while he may be able to play if a playoff berth were on the line, it really doesn't make sense to put your young star running back out there on a questionable ankle. There's a high likelihood of missing week 16 here, and about a 50-50 shot they just shut him down for the year. Now, Chase Young, hard to predict which week now, but Young could realistically return at any time. For those worried about him long term, I just encourage patience. There's no indication that his knee is actually acting up, but confidence in the knee is key to safely returning to play. If he doesn't trust it, that in itself is a risk factor for re-injury. So Washington is doing the right thing to take it one week at a time here. Most young stars do come back over a slow ramp up in their snap counts. Then Dallas Goedert, very likely playing week 16 against Dallas. If he's active, Goddard will be just outside the window where his injury would be expected to impact productivity. Look for a full week of practice and a strong bounce back next week. He'll be in some DFS lineups for me. Then we have Tyler Lockett. Reports suggested as little as 1 week missed, but the average is actually 3 to 4. So wide receivers coming back at 2 is possible, but I certainly would not be planning on it based on historical data. After the 4th week, performance impact is relatively minimal. For reference, Chris Godwin had a similar injury previously and missed 4 games. Then we have Treylon Burks. Although new concussion protocols have more variation than the old ones, it would still be a pretty heavy outlier for a player to miss a 3rd game. If you have to bet now, it would be heavily in favor of Burks playing week 16, and wide receivers don't really see any performance hit when they return. Then we have Lamar Jackson. The average timeline here takes about 2 to 4 weeks, so there's a solid chance to play week 16. Data does suggest lower than average rushing production through week 17. And then his teammate, J.K. Dobbins. The last 2 weeks were likely not a fluke. Our algorithm projects Dobbins to be at 90% of pre-injury form at this point, now 16 months out from his major knee surgery. Running back ramp-ups average 3 to 4 games, so we'd expect his touches to keep rising week 16 and 17. Then we have Deebo Samuel. MCLs average 2 to 4 weeks, moderate high ankles 3 to 5. The video of his injury looked pretty severe, but spreading the hit over the 2 joints probably helped either from becoming a season-ending one. Niners comments suggest a return week 18. Data suggests more likely return in the first round of the playoffs. Skill position players usually take 1 game to ramp back up to full production. And then we have Mike White. Now the average timeout is 2 to 4 weeks, but recent data does trend to be on the lower side of that spectrum. White has made it pretty clear that as soon as he finds a doctor to clear him, he will be out there. So we lean towards White missing week 16, but probably coming back shortly after that. And then we have Trey Hendrickson. Now, a broken wrist is going to be really tough to play through. Very likely out week 16, probably 17 as well, with a chance to come back wearing a thick cast for week 18. Shedding blocks, however, is going to be a challenge with only one hand, so this has a solid chance of impacting his production, at least initially when he first comes back.
Well, hopefully, Payne, Ravens fans are able to take a little bit of solace out of Deepak's update talking about J.K. Dobbins looking to be much closer to 100%, 16 months removed from his gruesome injury. Lamar Jackson potentially having a solid chance to be back under center, even if it is with limited mobility. Unfortunately for Jets fans, he corroborated what you thought to be the case in Mike Florio's report that Mike White may not be out there Thursday night against the Jacksonville Jaguars.
Yeah, that's... that's a tough one, especially with, you know, the playoffs on the line. But if it's Zach Wilson, we'll see what transpires. The rumor was that was mandated from above, and it's something we referenced on the podcast Thursday, where suddenly Zach Wilson, who did not play in the Buffalo game, was elevated on Wednesday to second on the depth chart. So we'll see if it's Zach Wilson again Thursday night, and we'll go from there.
We do have one final game to cover for week 15 before we put out a bow on yet another week of the regular season. And it'll take us to frigid Lambeau Field for the Green Bay Packers welcoming in the Los Angeles Rams. This number's been on the move on Monday morning, the 7 starting to evaporate from the market, turning into 7.5 with Green Bay, of course, a home favorite. Total in this game holding pretty strong in that 39.5 range. Green Bay, The worst record at 5-8 through 13 games since 2008, which was Aaron Rodgers' first season as starter there. The Rams, meanwhile, the fewest points per game at 16.8 by a defending Super Bowl champion all time. Familiar foes in Matt LaFleur, knowing that he has served as the Rams' offensive coordinator in 2017 under Sean McVay. And the two apparently have shared quite the kinship, commiserating over miserable seasons on opposite coasts, or in the Midwest, as the case may be for Green Bay. You look at the Packers, 0-4 ATS this year in their last four games as a home favorite. Four straight Packer games, however, have gone over the total as they're averaging nearly 56 points per game in those contests. Green Bay, very healthy coming out of their bye week, all things considered. The Rams, the usual suspects on the injury report. But the big one that we think could be a long shot to play would be starting center Brian Allen. Payne, when you look at this matchup, we know that Green Bay has been extremely vulnerable against the run. We know that the Rams have not been able to run the football with any level of efficiency week in, week out. Is this a game where Sean McVay decides he's going to feed Kyren Williams and Cam Akers 60 times and hope they can pick up 3 yards a carry?
It's a good question. I mean, you do have the Rams coming off a mini bye, and it's prime time, and Sean McVay fancies himself an innovative and great offensive mind. So maybe we see some interesting things here, and Baker Mayfield will know more of Sean McVay's offense, and there's likely to be some things the Rams do with Baker Mayfield that haven't been put on tape yet, and so that's maybe interesting early. To the naked eye, it's possible the Rams do have some success on the ground, and you mentioned it's smart to keep an eye on Brian Allen, the Rams starting center. He's questionable to this point. I haven't seen him officially downgrade, and he did get some practices in this week, so very important guy to keep an eye on. But I think the one thing that we've talked about anytime we've broken down a Packers game is their inability to stop the run. They're dead last and schedule-adjusted run defense. And if you look at the last 2 weeks, the Rams have started to show an ability to run the ball. Ninth in rushing success rate over that stretch. Now, I get it. It's the Seahawks. It's the Raiders last week, and those aren't like the best run-stopping defenses, but certainly the Packers are in a class of their own, as we just mentioned, in a very bad class. Now, Joe Barry's defense did get a good glimpse of Baker Mayfield back in week 16 last season. They turned Baker over four times. Baker's completion percentage was 7% worse than expectation, and Baker had a solid run game to support him, where I think Chubb went for over 120 rushing yards. So this defense, both in scheme and its players, did get a look at Baker Mayfield last season in an offense that he did know better and really did a nice job stopping him. But ultimately, I think you'll know pretty early on here in this game, right? I mean, it's a Rams team that had Super Bowl aspirations. They're coming off their mini bye. It was a big win. It's holiday season, right? And I don't know what the Rams were doing. We did see Baker Mayfield in the nightclub after that big win. But you're going to Lambeau Field, right, with freezing cold temperatures. The season's over. I think you'll know pretty quickly if the Rams want to be there. So maybe this is a game I look to trade live here.
What
in terms of the other side, do you want to hit that one individually, or how do you want to go about it? I'll let you lead the way.
No, I was just going to ask, in terms of when you look at Green Bay, I know they're mathematically not eliminated from the playoffs. Some of the player comments say if they win out and they get some help, there's a path, obviously, to crashing the back end of the NFC playoff picture. And when you look at Green Bay, they've obviously found something in North Dakota State rookie Christian Watson, who has 8 touchdowns in his last 4 games. You've seen his odds shorten considerably to be the offensive rookie of the year alongside Garrett Wilson. Chris Olave has fallen off a little bit, and Kenneth Walker probably not in the mix given some of his struggles recently. But you do have a tandem of running backs that are capable of performing in cold weather, and A.J. Dillon, who's a load to bring down, Aaron Jones, kind of that dual threat runner and receiver coming out of the backfield. And one thing that we have seen in the course of history with Aaron Rodgers in prime time and frigid temperatures, this is almost like his badge of honor that he wants to go out there and perform to a high level. So when you're looking at Green Bay and the best attack plan they have offensively for going after a Rams defense, where do you see their keys to success?
I think that's really the interesting part to this. And you actually said something at the very top of this, was that the Packers are pretty healthy. And aside from David Bakhtiari, who's rarely ever healthy, you are seeing a very much improved team in terms of its health. And quietly, if you're watching Green Bay's offense, started to look a little bit different the last month, right? Top 10 in both schedule-adjusted rushing and passing efficiency over this four-game stretch, and that's against four defenses that combined to average out in the top half of the league. And over this four games, they're seventh in EPA per play. So Green Bay's offense is quietly starting to get back on track, and now you get Dobbs to pair with Watson, who you mentioned, so it gives Rodgers some weapons. You have 15 days off, so probably really good indicator that Rodgers' thumb is feeling a little bit better, Aaron Jones' shin feeling a little bit better. The one area where the Rams have been vulnerable defensively is through the air, but they do get Troy Hill back. They got him back last week, played pretty well, so that's huge to have him in the slot. But I'm interested to see what the game plan is for the Packers off this bye, because what they've really been doing is, yes, efficient passing the ball, but they're still bottom 10 in the league in pass rate over expectation. They're very much a run-first team. And that's the one area where the Rams have kind of remained solid, right? Fifth for the full season metrics in terms of schedule-adjusted run defense, seventh in rushing success rate allowed since their Week 7 bye, where they could have all packed it in and quit during this, you know, massive losing streak where tons of guys are down on the defensive side of the ball, specifically along the D-line, right? I mean, we're playing interior linemen out on the edge, and you said something last night via text that makes a lot of sense. We'll probably see some Christian Watson end-arounds and maybe some reverses to make sure those ends don't cheat inside like they did frequently against the Raiders, where Mac Hollins had a couple end-arounds that were wildly efficient. The one thing that I have seen, at least on this side of the ball, and again, I haven't bet this game. Clearly, you know, you're watching some game day steam here on the Packers. It's not just public money coming in. So do the Green Bay Packers make a nice teaser leg? Potentially. Are there some props to attack? I haven't bet any personally, but the one that seems to be coming to the top of the list from all my guys that are sending me is kind of a focus on Alan Lazard. So, you know, game script would indicate the Packers are going to be in a lead. We know they like to run the ball, as I mentioned, right? They're very, very much a run-oriented team. You have Christian Watson, who's taking on a larger role. Romeo Dobbs is back. A lot of the other receivers are getting healthier, and some of the things that the Rams do defensively with their zone haven't really led to big Alan Lazard games. So that's kind of the prop that I've been hearing is Lazard under 44.5, but I haven't bet it myself yet. Still trying to do some digging there.
Hey, you know what? Sometimes when you're looking at the betting market, the side and total don't offer you the most compelling angle to try and take, and you have to kind of explore some of the other avenues to get yourself involved. And if that may be the prop market, we've seen it be extremely lucrative as some of those game day limits continue to increase. So definitely bears watching, and I'm very curious to see how Green Bay comes out and attacks. Like you said, a high level of familiarity between these two teams, extra time for both of them to prepare to figure out unique wrinkles that they may not have put on tape previously. Remember, you can follow Payne on Twitter at Payne Insider. I'm Todd Furman. You can follow me there. Most importantly, follow the podcast at Bet the Board. When you're looking at the schedule for the holiday week, we'll be back with you on Thursday to cover all things National Football League. A couple things in flux, may have a little bit of a bonus bowl coverage for you in the middle of the week. But again, that's why you need to subscribe to the Bet the Board podcast. Make sure all of that information is right there at your fingertips. If you haven't already done so, the Bet the Board newsletter, another great vehicle to remind you about all the content that's being produced on a weekly basis, whether it's articles, whether it's props. And boy, we needed every yard possible for that newsletter best bet in terms of the prop with Kareem Hunt at 25.5. Payne definitely got our sweat Saturday afternoon.
Yeah, you know, listen, I always try to view things through a lens that maybe others don't, and I always look at stuff like that, and I think he ended with 24 rushing yards, so it did become a little bit of a sweat going under 25.5, but I think you know when you have a really good bet is when everything goes against it and it still wins.
Very true.
And so when you look at a game there where a team you didn't expect to be up double digits the final quarter and a half was, which would indicate a little bit heavier of a run script from Cleveland, and the yards per carry in which Kareem Hunt was able to get there would indicate that going over again, and it just doesn't go over despite those two elements, which you really didn't plan for. I thought it was a pretty solid investment there. Just if you watch what's transpiring there, his carries have really started to subside. And in a game where possession's going to be really key, and you saw how long and drawn out some of those possessions were, you typically don't see the exchange as much between Chubb and Kareem Hunt. Chubb's refreshed because Baltimore's going on these elongated drives. So that was kind of the premise for that
one. Hey, all good things come to those who do the homework, put the time in, and obviously worked out extremely well for us and our listeners. Anything else you would like to add before we close up shop on a Monday morning?
No. Just back on Thursday with the NFL, a possible introductory bowl podcast on Wednesday. We'll see. And we'll definitely break down some of the bigger games with the New Year's Six games in a podcast with the trio. Right now, I'm trying to fight off a cold that I think is coming. That's my main prerogative over the next handful
of
days.
Take your shot of steroids, take your Zycam, whatever it takes to flush that out of the system. I mean, this is the stretch run. We need you at 100%. We know everybody is technically listed as questionable as you get into the twilight of the NFL regular season, so we'll expect you to be at your best on Thursday. Rest up, recover, drink that green juice, and get things rolling. Best of luck to all of you, our loyal listeners. Thanks, as always, for tuning in, and regardless of where your investments take you on Monday Night Football between the Packers and the Los Angeles Rams, want to wish you the best of luck, and hopefully we'll see you at the window.
Thanks for listening to Bet the Board. You can catch Todd and Payne every Monday, Wednesday, and Thursday during football season, breaking down the biggest NFL and college football games. And to make sure you don't miss any free best bets, subscribe to Bet the Board on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.